that is Superficial, from the album Superficial by Montrealer Uri, who I cannot recommend.
You are listening to From Embers, a weekly show on CFRC 101.9 FM about anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice. We are broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples on land that has come to be called Kingston, Ontario, Canada, because of the thievery and brutality of the Canadian state and its empire-loving parents. From Embers is about fires, some real and some metaphorical. Fires started generations ago and tended to over the years. Little sparks all across this territory that we hope will grow, spread, and engulf the thieving state called Canada and the capitalist system that has plagued this land since the fur trade. Today on From Embers, I'm sharing my interview with author and activist Eric McBay about the recent UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. Hearing the same old alarmist language in the news this past week about how governments need to act fast to reduce greenhouse gas emissions immediately or else, with the new admission that some of the effects of climate change will now be irreversible no matter what changes are made, I wanted to check in with Eric about whether or how we should react to news and numbers like this, what to do in the face of increasingly hopeless sounding calls to action to reduce fossil fuel consumption and greenhouse gas emissions, and the prospects for meaningful change in a context where many of these forces probably cannot be stopped soon enough. Here's my interview with Eric.
My name is Eric McBay. I'm an author, an organizer, and a farmer. And one of the major focuses of my work for a long time has been climate justice. But more generally, I write about how to build more effective movements and how to have more effective social movement strategy. So my most recent big book was Full Spectrum Resistance, which is a two-volume exploration of how to build more effective movements from 2019. And then last year, 2020, in February, my colleague Pamela Cross, a lawyer, and I put out a booklet called Direct Action Works, which is a legal guide to nonviolent direct action in Canada.
Great. And we can direct people also to a past interview with you about your big book, your two-volume book as well, that Wonderful. We have on the show in the past. I did want to talk to you about this climate report that just came out, because you are the person who I go to discuss these things. So are you able to just outline for us, for me and for our listeners, what the latest IPCC report actually says about climate changes and the future of the planet?
The kind of media tagline of the latest IPCC report has been, you know, code red for the planet, that the climate emergency is really clearly described in this report. And so they are, their language is more blunt than in the past. They talk about the unprecedented warming that's happening, that's clearly caused by humans, by industrial activity, though they focus on human-caused climate change. They make it clear that it's already affecting every continent, every part of the planet is being affected by extreme weather that we can blame on climate change. And we've all seen that in the news already this year. And in recent years, you know, every kind of extreme weather. So they predict that no matter what we do, no matter what scenario we're looking at, the global temperature is going to keep increasing until at least the mid-21st century in all of those scenarios. And right now, they are predicting that the temperature is going to rise more than the 2-degree scenario. And that's something that the UN has been talking about for a long time. So the UN, the IPCC, often likes to contrast two different warming scenarios, 1.5 degrees Celsius increase and 2 degrees Celsius increase. And 1.5 is kind of the target that seems to have been generally agreed upon in the United Nations and in kind of these global talks. And the difference sounds like a small one, the difference of 0.5 degrees between those two scenarios. But the effects on humans and other ecologies are much greater in a 2-degree scenario. So a 2-degree versus 1.5 degree, I mean, that means essentially all coral reefs are going to go extinct. You know, huge areas of tropical rainforest and boreal forest could be destroyed. Mass human displacement. So that's the difference. That's what they're saying right now, is that we're more on the side of the 2-degree scenario. And some of the scenarios that they look at are even more extreme, right? They're 4-6 degree increase. And to put that in perspective, when the temperature here where we are in Ontario was 4 to 6 degrees cooler than it is now, this was covered in a kilometer of ice, right? That extreme temperature is not even something that they really discuss in the report, because it's so dramatic, because it goes so far beyond anything in human experience. They are kind of cautiously optimistic about a few things in the framing of the report. So one of the things that they talk about is that the rate of emissions rise has slowed. And that's to be honest, that's a very small thing to be excited about, right? Because the temperature is increasing, the amount of carbon dioxide, the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere are increasing. They're being added to each year, but the rate at which we add more each year is not as fast as it used to be. But they use this to interpret that maybe some of the really bad scenarios are less likely. Another aspect that they emphasize in the report and in some of the media is that certain aspects of climate change are reversible. And so this is something that they really push, that even though this is not a very optimistic report in many ways, it's very blunt and very stark, there are aspects that can be reversed with sustained global effort. So if essentially every country is able to significantly cut its greenhouse gas emissions in a very rapid way, then it's possible that rising carbon dioxide levels, we're kind of locked into several decades, we're locked into another generation of rising CO2 levels, that those could start to decrease near the end of the 21st century. So again, that's not the sort of thing that makes me want to jump up and dance, right? I do think it's good that there's potential for reversibility of some aspects of climate change, but it's also a really dangerous game politically, because if you're telling decision makers and the general public, hey, this could destroy the planet, but we might be able to reverse some of it later, I don't know if as an organizer that's the framing that I would choose, right? And obviously I'm an organizer, not a climate scientist, so that's a tricky decision. We can come back later maybe to some of the emotional aspects, and I think that they're trying to avoid a sense of overwhelming, crushing despair by focusing on some of these good parts. But there are some aspects of climate change that are not going to be reversed in a time frame of thousands of years, right? So sea level rise, that is mostly driven by melting ice. And a lot of the ice in glaciers and at the poles, that accumulated thousands of years ago during the last ice age. And so that ice is not going to reform even at the temperatures that we have now, let alone in a greenhouse future. So some of that change, some of that sea level rise and these other climate effects, they're essentially locked in at this point. So that's kind of the balance, that there are some things we can change. There's some things that we can reverse. We can work really hard to avoid the worst scenarios. But at this point, we're already locked into some pretty significant long-term climate impacts.
Do you personally find the numbers and rhetoric in this report surprising? Like, should we be surprised by this?
I've been a climate justice activist for probably 20 years at this point, and I don't think, you know, looking back, and I've done that a lot in the last week, looking back at conversations I had with climate scientists that I've worked with 10 or 20 years ago, and I don't think there's anything in this report that would have surprised them. I think that climate scientists, especially in the UN, in these massive reports that involve, you know, hundreds of institutions collaborating together, they tend to be very conservative. And sometimes that's politically conservative, but mostly, I mean, they are terrified of saying anything. They're terrified of being called exaggerators. They're terrified of being called alarmists. And the right wing has really pushed, especially over the last 10 to 15 years, this narrative that climate change is either a hoax or it's being exaggerated for ideological reasons by kind of climate scientists or these leftists who want us to all stop driving cars or something. And so because of that rhetoric, because of that right-wing rhetoric, which has been funded by oil companies in a very deliberate attempt to influence the public dialogue and public opinion, climate scientists are really hesitant and only say the things in public that they're absolutely certain about. And often, and this is also the case in this report, that means saying things that we've already observed. So what they're talking about in a big chunk of this report is actually looking at the climate change that's already happened in the last couple of decades and in the last 150 years. And one of the things that's come out of that's been really clear is that the Earth is a lot warmer already than it was compared to pre-industrial levels. So usually 1850s kind of used as that cutoff point before really large amounts of coal started being burned. And so the global temperature is at least 1.1 degrees warmer than it was in 1850. But almost all of that warming has happened in the last 40 years. Almost all of that warming has happened in the lifetimes of, you know, most of the people in society. So that's really important to remember, I think. That said, there are a few things that are kind of different or that are maybe new about the framing of the report. And they emphasize some things that they didn't previously emphasize. So one of the things that plays a really major role in this report, especially if you read through the subsections and not just the executive summary, is the idea of tipping points. So tipping points in climate science are examples of ecological feedback loops, right? So if you look at the Arctic, in the early part of the 20th century, the Arctic was covered by ice most of the year, most of the time, right? And that ice cover has retreated significantly to the point that in the summertime now there's almost no ice in the Arctic Ocean. And ice itself, snow, is a white, very reflective color, right? So sunlight that's coming down from the sky, it gets reflected off back into space. But if that ice melts, then you have open water that's a dark color. It's absorbing that light. It has a different albedo, is the term that climate scientists use. And so all of a sudden, this kind of warmer, this warming in the water becomes a feedback loop where it becomes really hard for that ice then to reform, and it gets warmer. There are other examples in the Arctic, in the ocean, and also in permafrost of methane that's frozen there. Methane is a really powerful greenhouse gas that has been frozen in different forms in the Arctic, again, for thousands of years. And that is starting to bubble up because of these tipping points. And so that means that no matter what humans are doing to change their environmental emissions, no matter, you know, how much fossil fuel is being burned, those are sources of greenhouse gases that can be kind of set off independently, almost like ticking time bombs. Forests are another big potential tipping point. The Amazon rainforest creates its own climate, but if it reaches a certain point of drought, then it may start to die. And we already see that happening in fragmentation in some parts of the Amazon. Even the boreal forest in Canada, Research suggests from the last couple of years that there are large parts of the boreal forest that, instead of sucking up carbon, as we expect trees and forests to do, they've actually shifted into net carbon emitters. So because of sustained drought and warming, and because of insect pests that are invasive and that are attacking trees weakened by these changes, they're actually emitting more carbon than they're sucking up. And so that's a huge problem. Because it makes it really hard to reverse climate change. And it also means that it's easy, potentially, for us to get bumped into some of these more extreme scenarios that right now the IPCC is rating as less likely. But that's changed a lot in this current report. So tipping points in the last report was mentioned about 27 times. In this report, it's mentioned 97 times. And a lot of these potential tipping points, they've significantly increased their rating of its probable occurrence. So they think it's much more likely that a lot of these tipping points will happen. And in the context of what we were talking about before, in terms of how cautious climate scientists are, I mean, this is often reflecting the opinion of climate scientists 20 years ago. So if we're projecting forward, you know, I think a lot of climate scientists now would rate these tipping points as being even more likely.
I think the basic framework of how this is being framed, like, this is happening, it's happening more than we thought, things are really bad, time is running out. If we don't reduce emissions by X amount, by X time, the effects may become irreversible. There may be these sort of runaway feedback loops. To me, this sounds like not new, right? The numbers, of course, have changed. But like, why hasn't this knowledge already resulted in a reduction in climate emissions? Like, what is the failing here? Because for me, it seems like it's not a lack of knowledge that has caused this, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can see even many of these same predictions in internal documents by fossil fuel companies, right? Companies like Shell, in the 1980s, were already building their ocean-based oil rigs at a higher altitude because they knew that they were causing sea level rise. Exxon, I mean, the predictions that some of these companies made in the 1980s and even before are shockingly accurate. And global warming is something that scientists have known about since the 1800s. A lot of this is not new. And I think part of the answer to your question comes from the words that don't appear in this report, right? So if we went and did a search in the 4,000-page PDF, some words that don't appear: capitalism, colonialism, environmental racism, social movements, refugee doesn't appear in here. I mean, this is a document which, of course, is explicitly focused on some of the physical science of climate change. But all the same, I don't think that we can, in good conscience, divorce that from the massive human impacts of this. And I think that has been one of the fundamental problems that even climate scientists who understand this so well are afraid to speak really bluntly about the impact that this is going to have, right? They talk about, even in some of their good scenarios, scenarios that require dramatic, transformative changes in the global economy. They're still looking at multiple meters of sea level rise. And, you know, in Bangladesh alone, a country of 160 million people, most two-thirds of the country is within 5 meters of sea level, right? And is already being affected by saltwater infiltration, saltwater that's getting into the water table, affecting people's ability to grow crops. So in their good scenarios, we're talking about displacing hundreds of millions of people. And those are overwhelmingly poor, Black, Indigenous people of color living near the tropics. And so that is a key reason why that we haven't seen action, because of environmental racism, because of white supremacy, essentially, because the majority of wealthy countries that are further north are not only insulated from many of the early and worst effects of climate change, some of them actually feel like they might benefit from it.
So according to like their own words, what would actually need to happen to slow these effects at this point? What are some of the changes that would have to happen in society for us to get some of these better case scenarios that are being outlined here?
Right. So they are talking about really deep deep cuts, deep changes to reduce fossil fuel emissions. And so fossil fuel emissions are really key, and methane in particular is something that they focused a lot on in this report. And that's for a couple of reasons. So methane is also called natural gas. Methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas. It's about 300 times as powerful as carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It traps huge amounts of heat. The only good thing about methane is that it doesn't stay in the atmosphere as long, right? Carbon dioxide, it stays in the atmosphere until it's sucked in by the ocean or by growing plants, essentially. And methane actually does break down over, you know, a decade or two, which is good. But it also means that methane, looking at the next 10 to 20 years, the impact of methane is going to be really huge. And that's one of the key things that the report suggests focusing on to reduce. So in Canada, if you break it down by industrial sector, by economic sector, of course, the oil and gas industry is by far the biggest emitter. It's bigger than most other sources of fossil fuels or of greenhouse gases. But it's also the biggest source of methane. And of course, part of that is things like fracked natural gas. And I want to mention, too, that Canada, when gas is exported or fossil fuels are exported, Canada does not count that as its emissions. So it's exporting these emissions, but it's saying, oh, well, we're not, you know, we're adding more energy efficient refrigerators at Loblaws. So just don't look at these other, you know, these exports. But even within Canada, emissions of methane from the oil and gas industry are enormous. We're talking about the equivalent of almost 60 megatons of greenhouse gases every year. So that's almost as much as all of agriculture, all the greenhouse gases released by agriculture across the country. Something like almost 60 megatons are released as fugitive emissions. And so fugitive emissions are releases of greenhouse gases, emissions of greenhouse gases that aren't doing anything useful. Right. So if you have a natural gas stove at home and you turn it on and make a pot of tea, those aren't fugitive emissions. That natural gas has been used to kind of do something useful for humans. Fugitive emissions are methane that is either released from an oil well or comes from a leak in an oil pipeline, or maybe they're fracking and a bunch of oil just bubbles up from the ground through streams and lakes and goes up into the atmosphere. And the amount of that release is absolutely enormous. I mean, the amount of fugitive methane released by Canada is more than many entire countries' impact on climate. And so recently there's been a whole effort to use things like drones and satellite imaging to try to track down where some of these fugitive emissions are coming from and how much methane is actually being released. And it's always inevitably much more than kind of the official numbers are claiming. So this is something that the IPCC says, and that in Canada as well, we can really focus on is the issue of fugitive emissions. And really limiting the expansion of the oil and gas industry, limiting fracking, and limiting new pipelines are key ways that we can address that particular problem.
The report, and especially a lot of the news media about the report, is really emphasizing this new science that proves that climate change is in fact caused by humans. Which is interesting, I guess, if you're like a climate change denier, although I suspect they still aren't going to trust the UN to tell them whether humans are causing climate change or not. But also, I feel like calling it human-generated climate change is kind of slippery in a way. Actually, which humans are to blame for this? And like, how do you as like a person with ethics think we should frame these kinds of questions in terms of like the responsibility of humankind? I feel like it can easily get us, especially like us as like younger people, to this kind of place where it's like, oh yeah, people suck and they're never going to change. Like, they're just going to keep driving or whatever. Is there a way we can sort of like frame this in a way that's more compatible with like a social justice outlook as well? Can we sort of talk about this? Like, I don't know. Are there enemies here? Are there people here who we can sort of blame for these problems other than each other?
Yeah, there are absolutely enemies. And I totally agree with you that it's such a slippery, misleading term to say human-caused climate change or anthropogenic climate change. Climate change is really caused fundamentally by two things: burning fossil fuels and rich people. And mostly rich people burning fossil fuels, if you want to break it down. So if we want to look at our enemies, those are the people who are expanding fossil fuel infrastructure. And that's not a neutral thing, right? I mean, in Canada and all over the world, that is happening on Indigenous territory, largely on unceded Indigenous territory. And so the enemies in this case is really a group of very globally wealthy, often white supremacists, right? I mean, if you look at the examples in Canada, the people who are funding fossil fuel advertising and misinformation are often the same people who are funding white supremacists and racist media and these other things.
How likely do you think it actually is that governments and or the private sector would implement the recommendations that are going to come out of this report? Like how optimistic do you feel about the prospect of this just like happening as a result of the knowledge that comes from this document?
Well, I guess to use the language of the report, I would describe that as a low confidence outcome.
Sure.
So I have very little faith in governments doing the right thing for the right reason. Especially when it comes to fossil fuels. I mean, we've seen how the Liberal government in Canada has acted on this issue. They will declare a climate emergency one week, and then the next week buy a multi-billion dollar oil pipeline that private industry couldn't even build without them kind of pushing this through. So I don't actually think that governments are going to respond in a sufficient and prompt manner. And I think a lot of the climate scientists who wrote this report know that, too. You know, I was seeing interviews with some of them who were saying things like, this might be my last IPCC report because we've been doing this for so long and the numbers keep going up and it keeps getting ignored. So I'm not sure why I'm doing this except to document for, like, posterity what's happening. If we want to see fundamental change in our societies, if we want to see this problem genuinely addressed by governments or corporations or anyone else, that's going to require really powerful social movements. That's going to require a diversity of tactics, and that's going to require direct action. You know, one of the things just before the pandemic that was really giving me life was the size of the Wet'suwet'en solidarity struggle in the early 2020, right? I mean, there is a group of people who are trying to stop an oil pipeline from coming through their land, a fossil fuel pipeline, who are asserting their autonomy as a nation and First Nation on unceded land. And to see the degree of solidarity from Indigenous and settler people coast to coast was truly inspiring. I think that was a time that I felt some of the most hope in maybe the last decade in terms of the climate crisis. And we saw in that struggle how effective even a small number of committed people can be when they want to engage in direct action that disrupts capitalism, that disrupts colonialism, that disrupts the fossil fuel economy. And I think if it were not for the pandemic, that movement would have continued to grow and gain momentum, and I think would have seen some more definitive positive outcomes, which is one of the many kind of terrible impacts the pandemic has had on our lives and on our planet. But I think, you know, that those struggles have not gone away. The Wet'suwet'en are fighting just as hard as they had before, and I think as we maybe start to emerge from some of the worst of the pandemic, there's a lot more potential to engage in those sorts of action again, to support that sort of action. And I think we've seen growing momentum again on Indigenous issues around residential schools and colonial monuments. So I think there's a huge amount of positive potential there. And I think for me, one of the things that this report makes clear is that there is still a lot of room for social movements, for radical politics to intervene and to avoid the worst case scenarios, because that's what's going to do it. It's not going to be because, you know, Justin Trudeau decides he might like win another couple of seats if he makes some kind of statement on climate change.
Yeah, You are listening to From Embers on CFRC 101.9 FM, or you might be listening to the podcast edition of From Embers. We are talking to Eric McBay about climate change and what is to be done for a planet that may well be irrevocably damaged by industrial capitalism and fossil fuel use. As always, we welcome feedback on this and all of our episodes, as well as ideas for future content. Please get in touch by emailing us at fromembers@riseup.net. Here's the rest of my talk with Eric. I mean, there are people out there, and you're one of these people, who've really put, like, all the energy they had left available to them into these movements for the last 20 to 30 years already. We've been making these demands around specific actions, around specific numbers. I think at many moments we felt that we were strong, like that there were a lot of us that we were making a certain kind of gain out there. Is that impact tangible in terms of greenhouse gas emissions or climate change? Like, is it possible to truly see the impact of the environmental movement in like the historic data that we now have spelled out available to us?
Yeah, I think it actually is. And it's sometimes hard to tease that out from these big abstract, you know, blocks of data, which is one of the reasons that climate change is so hard to organize around, because it feels so big and abstract and diffuse and over a long period of time. It's much easier to save a single tree in a single neighborhood than to save the entire planet that we all depend on. But that said, I think that we can see in this data that social movements are having an impact. The fact that we're not in the very worst case scenario, I put that success entirely on different kinds of social movements, and in particular on indigenous struggles. Because we could be locked into a scenario of much more catastrophic warming, but we actually do have more breathing room than some of us were concerned about, according to this report. And we know, we've seen over the last, you know, 3 or 4 years, a number of major pipelines in Canada and the United States have been canceled. And that is because of social movements. That's because people, especially people on the front lines, indigenous communities, got out there and did direct action and were supported, and they won. It made it too expensive for these companies to do the terrible things that they wanted to do. And so in a lot of cases, they've quit. I mean, even, you know, cross-Canada pipelines, you know, Energy East, these sorts of things got canceled really very early in the process. And I think that's actually key if we want to kind of analyze some of the tactics that win. It's much like solving climate change. If you wait to the last minute, it's really hard. The longer you wait in the process, the harder it gets. And the earlier you, so, you know, once the pipeline's already being constructed, it's really hard to stop. And direct action can delay that and has occasionally canceled pipelines that they've already invested a lot in. But that's much more difficult. And Energy East, which is a pipeline that was kind of in its early days and not a lot of people have talked about it recently, that's a pipeline that was at the stage of being kind of shopped around at a National Energy Board hearings in different cities. And climate justice activists just went and shut down the hearings. You know, and again, it's not like 5,000 people or a million people went. We're talking like a dozen or two dozen really committed people who went and made a fuss and disrupted the hearing and shouted it down. And eventually the hearings were postponed and then canceled. And then the entire pipeline project was canceled.
It sounds like from what you're saying, like, there is an impact to our actions, for sure. I mean, I am of course persuaded that it is still worthwhile to fight, for example, the fossil fuel industry. But it also kind of sounds like even if we won every single campaign that we take on, our impact would be not enough, basically. Like, that there is not really the chance of, like, stopping or reversing climate change through those actions, at least in the short or medium term. And that there are going to be these really devastating impacts on some scale, no matter what, for some people. At what point does it make sense to either in addition to making demands of the state, or perhaps for some people instead of making demands of the state, pivot towards like protecting the vulnerable from these impacts and preparing for the effects of climate change? Like, is there a place for that? Can we do both?
So, you know, I'm an organic farmer, and so I have put a huge amount of my energy into kind of building a sustainable way of feeding people, of feeding my community, and doing that in a way that doesn't worsen climate change, but is also resilient against climate change and extreme weather and drought. And I think that's really important. I think that, you know, welcoming refugees is really important because, honestly, most of the refugees who are coming to Canada now are climate refugees one way or another, even if they're not called that. But, you know, in terms of tipping points especially, it's going to reach a point where it really becomes overwhelming, right? So no matter how good we are at welcoming refugees, we can't handle, you know, hundreds of millions or billions of people being displaced in a fair way. That scenario, I mean, in that scenario, the best case situation is probably avoiding overt fascism and struggling to contain a lot of the alt-right white supremacist forces that have been gathering steam in the last few years. So I think at this point, and probably for most of my lifetime, the calculus will be that it's still the best bang for our buck is on preventing further climate change. And that doesn't mean that other kinds of adaptation aren't important. I think they really are, but often that's because those things are beneficial for their own reasons, right? So if you are, in our case, building a farm that is resilient against climate change, that also means a farm that has more biodiversity, that has better soil health, and that, you know, is an educational farm, really, so that people can understand where their food comes from and how the climate is impacting their food supply. I think that building fairer, more equitable societies, likewise, that's necessary both to stop climate change and to soften the impact of extreme weather. And so that, again, is really an outcome that's worthwhile in and of itself, regardless of kind of the long-term effects on carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere.
It doesn't inspire a lot of hopefulness to think about these terms in such incremental ways. I think, you know, I, in many ways, like, saw myself in, like, the youth strikes, for example. Like, one of the first actions I ever attended was, like, a mass downtown action where we spelled out the word Kyoto with our bodies to demand that Canada implement the Kyoto Protocol. And I feel like I was being told that I could, like, save the world. Like, if someone had told me, like, oh, you can, like, very slightly reduce the negative impacts of climate change if you win this thing that you're probably not going to win anyway, like, I wouldn't have felt like marching as much as I did, right? I wonder, like, where hope can come from in a situation like this where it's, like, you're basically being told that some of the most devastating effects are irreversible. Mm-hmm. We're admitting that even the demands we're making of government would, in fact, not save us from a lot of these impacts. Like, what's someone supposed to tell themselves to keep doing this for 30 or 40 years at this point?
Yeah, and that's a huge question, and it's not an easy question, because for me, I mean, I have gone through periods where I did not feel very hopeful. And so I think there's a multi-part answer to that question. And part of it is that we really have to take care of each other, especially in those low moments. And that building a culture of resistance and building communities of resistance where we care about each other's feelings and that are nice places to be in, that's both what we need in order to win and also, like, kind of the intrinsically good thing. That's the setting that we all want to be in, right? That we want to live in, is a community that actually cares about us and our needs. So I think that sort of thing is really crucial. And then I think that in terms of balancing that tension between saying on one hand, you're going to transform the world, and on the other hand, like, oh, actually, even the best case scenario has kind of modest changes potentially in the next couple of years. I think that a big part of the answer for me is about building up that momentum. That, you know, I've studied a lot of different social movements, and a lot of them, most of them, started with a handful of people sitting down in a room together and saying, "What are we gonna? What the hell are we gonna do to fix this? Like, we're all totally f***ed." And despite that, there have been hundreds, thousands of successful movements that went from that kind of desperation to actually winning many or most of the goals that they identified. And so for me, it's not about, looking at the very, very long term. Even though in some sense as a climate justice activist, that's what I'm doing, right? I'm thinking about what's going to be good for people 300 years from now. But on a daily basis, for me, that actually means what is going to move things forward like today or this week? How can I make some positive improvement toward building a powerful social movement that will have the momentum necessary to make change? And I think that liberal environmentalism, it cuts off the time horizon too early, right? So it's like, it's not what do I do to build a movement that will create massive change? It's what do I do to address the climate change today? And the answer is very little most of the time, right? You can recycle something or not fly on a plane. But given what we know about the source of climate change, that it's caused by, you know, massive fossil fuel burning, mostly by rich people, I mean, we all know that doesn't have very much of an impact, these small lifestyle changes. And so I think what we need to do is kind of take the idea of a tipping point and kind of flip that around on its head. So sure, you know, we should be concerned about climate change tipping points, but we should also be constantly looking for social movement tipping points, political tipping points. Where are those moments where we can create rapid change that happens in a feedback loop, a positive feedback loop that happens much faster than anyone ever anticipated, even the activists, right? And this has happened many times in history. I mean, even Black Lives Matter in the last year. I mean, we've seen the way that people have jumped on that bandwagon, that it's become this really powerful, massive, energetic movement. And so I think if we continue to build our skills as activists, if we continue to build our networks among other people, and as we continue to build our analysis as well, then we start to find those cracks in the system, and we start to be able to find areas to pry them open. We can start to find those tipping points, because they're there. And they're going to become, I think, more obvious as the situation becomes more extreme, right? I think that even though COVID, the pandemic, had a negative effect on most social movements that I was participating in, I suspect that it actually gave a big boost to Black Lives Matter and some of the other movements that have become more successful in the last 18 months. Because when it's clearly an emergency, people are willing to act like an emergency. In the climate justice movement, our biggest enemy is normality, the sense that things are basically fine and maybe the government will fix stuff, or maybe like apocalypse is the new normal and we can't do anything. We need to find those moments where things don't feel normal, or we can push things away from being normal. And nature, climate changes and its effects on nature are certainly providing those opportunities more and more. You know, it's very obvious, it's in our face, the impacts of climate change. And we need to be able to focus public feelings, whether it's, you know, fear or anger or despair or all of these things, we need to be able to focus that in an energetic way on the people who are responsible. The community organizer Saul Alinsky famously said that you had to freeze it, personalize it, and polarize it. So not to be afraid of being polarizing, not to try to pick the middle road, because that almost never works, at least when you're talking about overturning deeply entrenched systems of inequality, deeply entrenched systems of power. I mean, I would like to see, for example, when there's an extreme weather emergency, that people really focus their efforts in those moments on fossil fuel companies that are responsible, and on particular people in those fossil fuel companies, and on, you know, members of government who are being intransigent on issues of the climate emergency. I think that we're reaching that point where most people would actually understand that. But I think we're also being hobbled by larger left liberal organizations that are afraid to be controversial. They don't want to lose their charitable status. They don't want to alienate, you know, middle class donors. And so they're caught in a way of doing things that maybe made sense 30 years ago, maybe, but absolutely does not match the situation now. And frankly, I think that's another point of intervention within movements, that if we want to create dramatic impacts, positive impacts on the climate, then let's backtrack that, right? That means, okay, we need to reduce fossil fuel emissions. That means changes by government and corporations. And that means social movements forcing that change, because that change is not going to come from rich people who are benefiting from destroying the planet. And that, one step earlier, means changing the way our movements work. And so that the issue of, like, white middle-class men dominating social movements and the liberal environmental movement in particular, that's not just a problem because of inequality and fairness within those movements. That's a problem because it's stopping the people who actually know how to make change from having their voices heard, from being in positions of leadership, from having access to resources. You know, during the 6 months before the pandemic, I was on a book tour, traveling all over the place, doing workshops about how to build more effective social movements. And there was a really stark difference in terms of how people responded to a particular question that I like to ask at the beginning of a workshop. So at the beginning of a workshop, I'll often ask in the introductory go around, you know, tell me your name and your pronouns. Tell me a social movement that inspires you. And there was a real tendency for people who were mostly white, mostly middle class, to answer that question in a more shallow way. To say something like, oh, Greta Thunberg or Extinction Rebellion, or, you know, something that had been in the news in the last few months. Whereas it was much more common for people of color, queer people, you know, trans people to give answers that demonstrated a much richer understanding of the history of social movements. And they would give answers, you know, going back decades from movements all over the planet, you know, doing all sorts of things. And I think that is partly because, you know, middle-class white men are used to having the government take care of them, are used to catering to their needs. So they don't need social movements most of the time. And so when they reach a point like the climate emergency where our survival depends on building effective social movements, they're like, oh gosh, what do we do? I guess I'll ask more politely for the changes that I want. Whereas marginalized communities, you know, people who've actually had to really struggle to get basic things in that process over centuries, they've developed this really deep understanding in many cases of how to build more effective social movements. I mean, those are where I see the most effective movement organizers around climate justice. They're coming from BIPOC communities by the great majority. And so that's, I think, a really critical thing to do right now and moving forward. If we want to have a livable planet in 100 years, then we need to fix these inequalities in our movements right now and really prioritize the voices of BIPOC organizers and give them resources, give them access to decision-making power. So, like, if, you know, I don't think many of your listeners are probably donating to, like, Greenpeace at this point, but if you're, you know, maybe your parents do, or maybe you know someone who's doing that, like, push them to send their money to organizers in Wet'suwet'en territory. Like, get them to give their money to frontline direct action organizations of that are led by young people of color especially, right? Like, that's what's going to cause the tipping points now that we need to build movements that can preserve a livable future.
Those white men that you're talking about and that liberal environmental movement that you're talking about is, I think, what most people think about as, like, the climate movement, right? And I agree with you that movements like the movement to support Wet'suwet'en and people defending their territory against a pipeline would be good for the climate if they succeeded, for sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Like, it comes, they go together, for sure. But, like, is there a movement that, like, cares about these numbers that is, like, a climate movement that isn't just exactly what you're talking about, like, totally dominated by these NGOs and white guys? Like, I wonder if there needs to be, like, a climate movement per se, or if the things we're talking about are, like, already being fought for other more intuitive reasons that don't require, like, charts and numbers and all these things. But in fact, people just kind of know. They're like, of course a pipeline across my territory is bad. Like, that's crazy. Don't build that. Is there a climate movement specifically, like a movement that's about climate change? Does there need to be, like, is it really something that we should be a part of and grow and build? Like, is that where we should set our energies?
I mean, I think we do. I think we need intersectional movements, and climate justice should be a big part at this point of most movements, because it affects the success in the long term of essentially every struggle. And at the same time, I feel like those established, you know, liberal organizations are often a barrier to climate movements doing the things that they need to do, or climate campaigns. So I think there is a big difference, though, in I mean, the movements that you're talking about that are driven by people's immediate needs. And, you know, that's been a key part of the environmental justice movement going back to the 60s, at least, that those are communities of color that are affected by pollution, that are affected by garbage dumps, all of these things that they see directly in their face. And so they fight against it for a bunch of these overlapping reasons. And sure, what we might call environmentalism is a part of that, but it's often about fighting against racism, about fighting against classism, these other kinds of intersecting forms of oppression. And those movements or those campaigns, they tend to be more localized, more ephemeral, oftentimes, right? And part of that is because they don't have the same access to resources as the kind of more liberal environmental organizations. I suspect that if those movements had more access to resources, if they were the ones getting donations instead of, you know, the Sierra Club or whatever, not to pick on any particular group, but I think that those movements would actually have many of the positive characteristics that I see in organized movements. They would have, you know, offices and spokespeople who can get on the media more easily. But they are often held back from that because of the lack of resources. There are certainly examples of movements that have fought against environmental racism and that have fought these other struggles over a period of decades or even generations, who've been able to achieve some of that at the local level. Typically, they're often more kind of regionalized for a bunch of reasons, and access to resources, I think, is only one of those.
I feel like a lot of people I know have had this trajectory that's like, they were really into the climate movement, they were really into environmentalism, and they've sort of tended towards this kind of more survivalist mentality, or more like, even more like mutual aid-based mentality. Looking at your body of work, I mean, it follows the exact opposite pattern. Your first book was like a survival guide for peak oil. Do you still think that, like, the collapse of industrial civilization is imminent? And what... like, what propels you now at this point to focus on, like, mass social movements? Like, why is this the moment where you're choosing to kind of do that?
I think for me, it's always been kind of a balance. So I've worked on different environmental justice movements since I was a teenager. I think that to be honest, we are seeing, I mean, we're seeing society collapse due to climate change already and due to colonialism, essentially, right? Like, that's what we've seen happen in Syria, for example, that you have these worsening droughts that cause crop failures, and then that intersects with the long-term effects of colonialism and neocolonialism to essentially cause these societies to fail, to collapse. And right now, that's been happening kind of on the margins. But I think we are going to see that happening on larger scale and more kind of in the metropole, more in wealthy countries. And again, often that is affecting marginalized communities. I mean, frankly, Katrina, Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, like, they haven't recovered from that. You know, a lot of the infrastructure, the physical infrastructure of Black communities was destroyed and was never rebuilt for them. It was rebuilt for more affluent, more white people. And so I think we are going to see that continue to happen more and more, and to be more in our faces, even in places like Canada. Mm-hmm. So I do think that mutual aid has a really critical role as we move forward. And as these kinds of disruptions, as extreme weather, as these things become more common, because it's also a way of building community and building trust and building movements, right? So
if people actually saw this climate report and they're currently feeling kind of like hopeless or lost or like concerned about climate change, what contemporary current social movements would you point people towards? Like, what are the things that someone should do if they read that in the CBC and they're like, oh man, the world is ending. What's next? Like, where should they go?
So right now, I mean, it depends on where you are physically, geographically, because even though it's a pandemic, I think it's still really critical to build movements that are face-to-face, where we actually know and trust people. I think that, I mean, and maybe it's just that I'm pretty fed up with it, but doing everything online is not fun, and it doesn't build the strong ties, for the most part, that we need for successful movements. So I would look in areas where you're operating, especially for Indigenous-led movements, because there are a lot of those going on right now, thankfully. I think there are a lot of smaller kind of distributed radical climate justice groups. And I think that for a little while, there was a real burst of kind of cooperative action, coordinated action. So, you know, we saw that with the youth marches and the student organization. We saw that even with Extinction Rebellion. Mm-hmm. But right now, that does not exist on the same scale. And I think in some cases, that's not a terrible thing, because it gives us a chance to really focus on acting in a way that's going to make the biggest difference. And so Extinction Rebellion had some, and does have in some places, some major limiting factors, some limiting beliefs, like the belief that you should be cooperating with the police, which no social movement should be doing. But I think there is going to be, especially with help, potential for more of that cooperation happening on a larger scale. And I think as we kind of emerge from the pandemic, that's another one of the crucial questions that we should be asking, is where do we have the opportunity to scale up this work, to cooperate with others, to kind of tackle bigger targets, whether that's a pipeline or something else.
Is there anything I didn't ask you about that you were hoping to talk about today?
I think the only thing maybe that we haven't talked about is just the fact that I think the pandemic really shows two kinds of routes for our future, right? On one hand, when the pandemic was declared and kind of in March of 2020, basically the entire economy shut down in like a couple of days. And it showed that it's actually really possible for every part of society to see.
T90.3 FM is proud to rebroadcast the following program entirely in the Mohawk language. The Mohawk, or Ganyatgahaga, are the original people of the unceded traditional territory known as Montreal, or Jojaake. The Ganyatgahaga, or people of the Flint, have two communities close by, and they are working hard at revitalizing their language. This program is part of those efforts, and it originally aired in Ganasadage on RKR Reviving Ganasadage Radio. And now, listen to Jojaake's indigenous language on CKUT.
Segu sawaguegu, wahni dio gigo, sawadam sadere ne oska de wanya weda noska, yo justo kwera zade fem, aguegu, watkwan hueradu, ayaosti, zwada ayaosti.